This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe.
Hi folks, welcome back. If you're with us for the first time, thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik Palmgren and this is Red Ice Radio. And we're coming to you from Sweden. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com as our websites. Follow along in our news, listen to our radio program, and of course we have much more for you in the archives going back to 2006. Check out our latest commentary, and we're currently working on a new episode of Red Ice TV, so much more is coming up. Today we're talking with Sterling Seagrave about Asia's secret history, Yamashita's gold, uncovering the bad behavior of very powerful families, and Sterling is going to cover the Marcos, Song, and Yamato dynasties. Seagrave grew up on the China-Burma border, fifth generation of an American family of medical missionaries and teachers working in Burma since 1832. Sterling was educated in Burma, India, and America. After 4 years as a reporter, writer, and an assistant foreign news editor for the Washington Post, he spent 10 years in Asia as a freelance journalist, contributing to Life, Time, Esquire, Atlantic, Smithsonian, GEO, Reader's Digest, and Far Eastern Economic Review. We're going to dive into it, so stay with us for much more. Well, this is a very interesting story, many incredible claims, and we're going to begin to discuss this now in more detail. But first of all, as usual, we have to welcome on the guest. So welcome to Red Ice Radio, Sterling Seagrave. It's good to have you with us today. Thank you for taking some time off talking with us in your busy schedule, Sterling.
My pleasure. Really.
Excellent. Now, why don't we begin talking a little bit about yourself here in the beginning. You have a long career writing many books yourself with your wife, of course, Peggy, who unfortunately couldn't join us here today. But just tell us a little bit about how you two got together, started writing, and a little bit later here we're going to get into some of the specifically some of the topics, of course. But just give us a little primer here, if you will.
Well, both of us started out born in the United States. My family had been living for a couple of hundred years as missionaries, medical missionaries out in Burma. So the U.S. was always a little bit strange and alien to me. I joined Time Life Books, where I met Peggy. I was a senior writer there. And she was a senior picture editor and researcher. So we began working on books together and did quite a few, 20-some, and eventually decided to get married. So it worked out well in the sense that she working as essentially researcher and editor in the beginning and me as a writer, made a good team, and especially when I discovered that she was able to find out things when she went out on a research trip that nobody else could. There was a famous episode in the Boxer Rebellion in China back in 1900, where the British correspondent, the most famous correspondent there, was George Morrison from Australia. And when he died, he left his papers to the Mitchell Library in Sydney. Peggy went down there to have a look through his papers and discovered that he had written two versions of the Boxer Rebellion, one for the British paper, where he wanted to make the Brits look good, and the other was a private diary that apparently nobody else had bothered to read very thoroughly. Peggy read through it and found that it denied, it said the opposite of what he had been saying in the newspaper. So it turns out that he was pocketing things while they were busy looting, while the Allied forces were busy liberating the legation quarter. And everybody was looting, and Morrison joined in. So she had this knack for discovering stuff that was just astounding. And it worked better and better, and we got a lot of pleasure out of collaborating on the text as well. So she began writing chapters for the different books, and it ended up being a good collaboration. We've written about 10 or 11 books now, nonfiction. And these are all biographies, or well, they're basically investigative books, mostly investigating the bad behavior of some of the richest and most powerful families in Asia, like Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek's wife's family and the Japanese imperial family, where they've often written about the men in the family, but nobody's ever written about the women before. So we did a book on the Japanese imperial family, in which both the women and the men are covered. And we discovered in the course of this, Peggy discovered, that Hirohito's mother was a Christian. She was a Quaker. And so, for that matter, were several of her sons. I don't know about Hirohito for sure. But when they had their various funerals, they had to have one public funeral that was Shinto, and another private funeral for the family, which was Christian. So this is the kind of thing that she would come up with as she went to work on various books. So it turned out to be just a really hell of a good collaboration for us. Plus, she has tremendous energy. In any case, we've concentrated on the really evil deeds, the underworld side of these extremely famous and I won't say notorious, because we're talking about Madame Chiang Kai-shek, and she was considered voted in the United States as one of the 10 greatest women on earth, one of the 10 most admired. So how did they get away with this? Well, they spent an awful lot of money on publicity and creating false images of themselves while they were busy siphoning off, looting, or extorting millions, in fact, billions of dollars. So it's been great fun for us. We've had a bunch of death threats, and we hid out for a year off the west coast of Canada. And, you know, just disappeared off the face of the earth for a while and kept a shotgun nearby. And the guys who came looking to kill me or us couldn't find us. So they went down to San Francisco and they murdered a Chinese journalist named Henry Liu. But, you know, this is fun in a sense for me. It's exciting. It's much more exciting than sitting in a newspaper. I used to work for the Washington Post, and there would be some exciting assignments or a chance to cover for somebody else at the White House. But it just isn't the same thing, because you basically do what you're told. Whereas if you're a freelance writer, You have to do it yourself.
Indeed, and we're going to get into some of the reasons here, of course, why someone might want to go after you, and some of the details of this is things that is contained within your work, within the books. And you have, well, I mean, your whole focus, as far as I've understand it, your lineup, what you have in terms of books, is focused on the Far East. Primarily, you have one, I think, that is about the Yellow Rain, basically, on, you know, Soviet developed, distributed by biochemical weapon. But majority is about Japan, the Far East, the Philippines, that we'll get into later. Was this now then a choice, or was it just that it happened to be in this area where there was a lot of undiscovered material, I guess, Sterling?
Just happened that way. In the case of Yellow Rain, that was actually primarily about Laos, because at that time, The U.S. was pulling out of its secret war in Laos, but there were still a lot of collusion going on against the communist Pathet Lao. And the Hmong people who were being on the U.S. side at that point, a lot of them were dying of internal bleeding, massive hemorrhaging and so forth, and nobody could figure out what was causing it. And they figured it had to be some kind of chemical weapon, but they didn't know what. So I got intrigued in this because I like Laos, and my family have been in Burma for a couple of hundred years as missionaries, medical missionaries. So I have an affection for the Laotian people and wanted to find out what the poison was. So I went out to Laos and had a look around, interviewed a lot of Laotians, talked to some American doctors who were specialists in severe burns and other damage to the skin and internal organs. And eventually I worked my way through all the books, all the encyclopedias of poisons until I came to the same group that penicillin belongs to, a fungal poison. Mm-hmm. And this was called trichothecine. In fact, I found one that so perfectly nailed on the head what was happening in Laos that I actually got it down to trichothecine-3. And a friend of mine who was a military attaché out there came back and stayed at my house over the weekend and complained to me that he had sent back so many samples from the thatch roofs. Why couldn't the people out at Fort Detrick, the specialists in chemical weapons, figure out what the poison was? And I think he concluded that they just looked at whether it was nerve agent or phosgene or something like that. So I called a friend of mine who was the chief forensic pathologist at the CIA, and I asked him to come over and have coffee with us. We talked it over, and I asked him if he couldn't have the people at Fort Detrick take these samples out and test them again, but this time test them for trichothecine-3. And he actually did it, and they found it all over the place. And in fact, they found it in Canada, in Norway, in Holland, and so forth. So that gave me a whopping big thing to be interviewed about. And I found myself getting interviewed by just about everybody, but the book wasn't in the bookstores yet. It had all happened so fast. In any case, the book made me famous, if not rich. And so that got me an invitation to do a book about Madame Chiang Kai-shek's family called The Song Dynasty. And Peggy helped me a great deal on that because she has a very clear eye for editing as well as for research. And the book became a bestseller all over the United States. And Madame Chiang did something very stupid. As you know, you can tell, I don't have a very high opinion, didn't have a very high opinion of her. Mm. But she got a hold of her cohort in Taiwan and had them drum up 3 full-page ads, one for the New York Times, one for the Washington Post, and one for the LA Times. And this cost her $86,000 per page. So it was pretty good promotion for me. And the next day, the book was a bestseller. It was denouncing me for deliberately misinterpreting Chinese history when all I was doing was telling the truth behind her family.
There's no such thing as bad publicity then, I guess, huh?
Yeah, good publicity. Yep. Her name wasn't even Song. The name of the family was originally Han. And when her father ran away from home and went off to the United States, the Americans had hardly ever seen at that time in the late 1900s, had they ever seen a Chinese, unless you were on the West Coast where they were building the railways. But they misunderstood his name and used it backwards. So his name Han was forgotten completely. That's his family name. And instead they called him by what would be for us our first name. So he became Charlie Sung. Wasn't his name at all. So she became Mei Ling Sung, and her sisters, the other Sung, three Sung sisters who are so famous, also were called Sung. And, you know, it was just strange, bizarre things like that would pop up. You would discover that it wasn't the person that you thought it was. There was no such thing as a Boxer Rebellion. There weren't any Boxers in Peking when the Boxer Rebellion was supposed to have happened. It was all made up by George Morrison. And, you know, it's George Morrison whose son is the love interest in Love is a Many Splendored Thing, the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The guy who dies in Korea covering the Korean War. So there are lots of things that make it very exciting to work on a book like this. You're looking at very famous families like the Japanese imperial family, the Marcoses, and you're getting into what they're really doing behind the false front. The false front being, oh, gee, we're just here to try to make this a Christian democracy. All the stuff you hear now about the Middle East is what you used to hear about the Far East during the last Far Eastern crisis, which wasn't all that long ago, back during the Cold War.
Sure.
And it seems to be starting up again. You know, it looks like the U.S. Navy's moving its fleet out into the Pacific, and they look like they're getting ready for something, but God knows what.
Hmm. Yeah, you're right. And they seem to maneuver in such a way that they... they get interest, if I can put it that way, in different regions throughout history, focus on that to be able to control it. And Japan and the Far East, as we know, has had an interest by many Europeans throughout history, of course, with the Jesuits being over there, and also with later the when the Protestants came along, the Dutch and so forth. Like if you look even at the... the Shogun series, right, shows a little bit of this and the interest of how they tried to manipulate the Japanese at the time.
The Shogun book was actually a composition of several different stories from different periods of Japanese history, which he just put together rather brilliantly and made it a fascinating novel. But when you get into the same stuff, and it's not a novel, but nonfiction, and you find that people are lying here, lying there. They're lying everywhere. They're stealing money. They're walking off with $600 million here and over there. T.V. Sung, the brother of Madam Chiang Kai-shek, once got the White House to give him the money for a whole shipload of tanks to be shipped to China during World War II. And actually, he just pocketed it. There was no ship. There were no tanks. And he made the whole thing up. He was brilliant at this. And everybody in the family was brilliant at this, except for the sister, the one of the three sisters who married Dr. Sun Yat-sen. She was a romantic, and therefore, I guess you could say, a bit naive. She believed things. The others didn't. They were all just a pretty villainous bunch. When Madame Chang died back just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, 2003, yeah?
Yeah. The Taiwan Times wrote an obituary of her in which they called her the most evil woman of the 20th century. And their last line was, goodbye and good riddance. Now, you never expect that from Taiwan, which she had been first lady of, and before that, first lady of China, married to that gangrenous monster, Chiang Kai-shek. But it's fun to do. You know, you discover things about people that they're desperate to hide. And
how do you and Peggy come over some of the material? What are you looking at, old archives, reporting, newspapers and such? Or where do you go to dig some of this stuff up?
Well, for one thing, Peggy reads a great deal. She reads in English and in French and so forth. And she connects things. She makes these intuitive connections. That's how I can describe them. It's intuitive. Somehow or another, you read something somewhere or you see something somewhere, and a connection occurs to you that hasn't occurred to anybody else. And you're a little bit astonished, so you look into it and see if you can't find out more about it. And then, by golly, you do. Now, once you've got the eye on the target, you begin to find things left and right that you've ignored before. And it's really wonderful because it gets exciting. And you get into cases where you understand why somebody was murdered and how they were murdered. Like the King of Siam, the young King of Siam at the end of World War II, was wrestling around with his brother, the current king. And a pistol that he kept under his pillow went off, and it killed the young king. Well, they blamed it on the guard at the door. But the problem was that the bullet that hit the king's head wasn't the same caliber as the pistol that was carried by the guard at the door. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of thing that switches you on, you know?
Sure. Now, in a few minutes here, I want to begin to discuss Yamashita's goal here, getting to the main topic, I guess, of today's program here. But would you say that, as we know, Sterling, people inherently have a reaction to, I guess, conspiracies and hidden history and things that are inconsistent if we begin to examine them from a historical perspective. Is that the kind of world, I guess, you would say that you and your wife Peggy is dealing in within the, you know, hidden things and inconsistencies and even conspiracies to that extent? Or would you classify it, put it in a different category?
I'd put it in a slightly different category. We're not interested in conspiracy per se because it's so commonplace. There's collusion going on all over the place. What we're looking for is a kind of conspiracy or collusion that is so bizarre that it just knocks you out of your saddle. And that's what gets us all worked up and excited. And we start finding out, is this true? This can't possibly be true. So we take a negative approach. And we see what survives the negative approach. Does it really turn out to be true? Like, could the mother of Emperor Hirohito really be a Christian in a Shinto country? I can't believe that that's true. But what Peggy found out is that when wealthy people in Japan want to raise a daughter, they don't want to send them through the normal raise your rich daughter in our private prep school. They want them privately educated. And so they send them out to the countryside. And the countryside out at the foot of Mount Fuji is a place where you would say the Christians have gone and settled and tried to stay out of everybody's way. Christians have gone to Japan from time to time over the centuries, but they usually get themselves killed and crucified because there's usually a reaction to them. The Quakers, you see, don't have churches, and they don't sit in pews and sing hymns. So they don't attract attention to themselves at all. And so the Quakers that went to Japan all went out and lived in the countryside at the foot of Mount Fuji. And one of the things they did while they were raising their crops was to educate the children of very wealthy people who were anxious that their children get a very modern education instead of an antiquated one. And in the case of Hirohito's mother, she was just one of many girls who went out to the countryside and came back highly educated, but also a Christian. So this astounded us. And it also astounded us that when she died, they had to have two ceremonies, one up front for the public, and the other one out back for the Quakers at the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. So these things are so bizarre and off the wall. They absolutely fascinate us. Mm-hmm. She went to Sidwell Friend's school, the Quaker school in Washington, D.C., which is one of the best private schools in Washington. The wife of her second son also went to Sidwell Friend's Quaker school. So he must be Quaker too. In fact, when he had his funeral, he had his private funeral out back and his public funeral out front. The front one was Shinto and the back one was Quaker. That's the kind of thing that we're looking for. We're not looking for a sort of sordid conspiracies. We've run into a few. For example, we did a book called Dragon Lady. We were asked to do this book, as we have been on several occasions. This is about the last Empress of China. And the reason we were asked to do it is because she was supposed to be a sex monster, psychopath, who murdered any number of lovers and enemies and so forth and so on. Just, imagine everything you can visualize about ancient Chinese empresses and how sinister they must have been, especially if they were sex crazed. So here's one who was already identified that way in all the books that had been written about that period of time, the last empress of the Manchu dynasty, which was all around, the turn of the century, 2000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, it turned out she wasn't any of that stuff. She was a nice girl. We thought we were going to be writing a book about a really sordid vamp. And it turned out that she was too nice to do anything like that. She liked little, Chihuahua dogs. And she didn't do the evil things she was supposed to have done. They were all taken out of the history books by a British guy who had run away from home because he was really weird. He'd been to Cambridge. And he was a genius at linguistics, so he spoke something like 12 languages, including Mongol. But he's the one who either wrote or co-authored all the books, all the first books on the Dowager Empress and the Manchu dynasty and its last years before it folded and was replaced by warlords. And it's all lies. It's just all lies. The guy was a nutbag. And he was George Morrison's leg man. So George Morrison couldn't be bothered to study Chinese. He didn't speak a word of Chinese. And so he couldn't report stories himself. He had to go on rumors. So this guy is the guy, Sir Edmund Backhouse. He inherited the barony. Edmund Backhouse is the one that made up all these stories about the Dowager Empress being a sex fiend and a poisoner and all the other bad things you can think of that girls can get up to. And none of it is true. And yet I may be sticking my neck out a bit here, but I'll say that every single book that has been written about her and her period simply repeats these same lies over and over and over again, because they're all copying Edmund Backhouse. And just like George Morrison was using Edmund Backhouse's material, everybody else was believing it. Professors are writing books in which they say the same thing.
Well, that's the problem when you go to the same reference material over and over again. So I suspect this is something that's happening around the world quite more often than we realize, Sterling, that the roles of the praised heroes and the demonized villains actually are reversed, right?
I really believe you're right. I think that there's a tremendous amount of lying in the world. And the lying, of course, is there to enhance either your power or your prestige or your financial resources, deepen your pockets. But unless you're aware that you're probably being lied to, you get taken in by this. And if it's cleverly enough done, you get completely turned around so that your whole point of view, like look at the United States right now, okay? You've got a country there that is absolutely convinced that Muslims are terrorists. All Muslims are terrorists. Even Muslims that are a different kind of Muslim are terrorists. And the number of Americans that actually believe this, whether they come right out and admit it or not, is astounding, astounding. Now, who was it last time around? Well, I can remember back during World War II when I was a kid. All Japanese had bad eyesight and crooked legs, and they couldn't fly. You know, they just nonsense put about.
Now, obviously, this is information then that goes against the mainstream, something we appreciate and enjoy to highlight for that reason alone, so that people can get hopefully closer to the truth by examining both sides of the story, as it were. And before we go even too far now into the first hour, I do want to try to get into the story about Yamashita's gold. You have written two books relating to this subject, the Yamato Dynasty, The Secret History of Japan's Imperial Family, released in 2000. And then, of course, the Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold, published in 2003.
There's actually a third one, and that's the Marcos Dynasty, because before we could finish that book, we had to deal with the storytelling about Marcos having hooked into a whole lot of Yamashita's gold.
Yeah,
which turned out to be true. And that's what got us worked up enough to look at the Japanese side of the story in Yamato Dynasty to see if the Japanese said, how could they possibly steal so much gold, so much silver, so much of so many things, and move it to the Philippines or Indonesia, or even get it back to Japan before the United States got into the war, because back in those days, they could move it through Korea, Manchuria and Korea, which they had already seized.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Americans finally got their submarine torpedoes working correctly, so that they could actually hit the target, they managed to block further shipping north to Japan. So gold, silver, huge Buddhas, you know, 7-ton Buddhas, things like that, solid gold, had to be moved to the Philippines instead and had to be hidden there. But the Japanese had this wild idea that they could somehow negotiate a truce in the war, in which eventually their peace settlement would grant the Philippines to Japan. And so they figured they could come back and get the gold whenever they wanted to.
Now, I want to get into this in detail, what happened. We should detail a bit about the background of Yamashita as well. But before we do that, before I forget, you said earlier as well that you were asked to write the books. By who? Your publisher or other folks here?
Right after the Song Dynasty was a big success. Well, it was not only a bestseller, but it was a Book of the Month Club main selection. And Paul Newman and George Roy Hill, the guys who did Butch Cassidy and The Sting, they bought the option to make a film of it. And so the thing was really rolling. And so at that point, Harper and Row asked me if Peggy and I could do the same sort of book as we had done on the Songs, but do it on the Marcoses, since at that very point, the Marcoses were, you know, facing the mobs in the streets. They hadn't been kidnapped by the U.S. yet. But it was getting hot. And so we agreed and we started working on the book. But it was only after they kidnapped Marcos and got him to Hawaii that more stuff came out about Yamashita's gold and what were they going to live on. And he was trying to borrow money from some alleged friends of his. But the story does turn out to be true. I mean, it was quite obvious even at that time that it was true that there was gold stolen in such vast quantities by the Japanese. It's just that in the West we're told, oh, there's only 120,000 kilos of gold in existence above the ground. And that simply isn't true. That's just nonsense. There's much, much more than that. The reason that there is so much more is because we're not talking about what's above the ground in the West, what's been, you know, mined poured into various size ingots. What we're talking about is all of Asia. And Asia didn't have banks, and they kept their gold hidden. They kept it hidden in the ancestral tomb. They kept it hidden under the house. They kept it hidden all over the place. But they have been saving gold for at least 3,000-4,000 years. I mean, we've written books about China going back to the Shang Dynasty, which is as far back as you can go with any certainty. In fact, it was a Shang vase that Madame Chang hit the Generalissimo with once when she got really mad. And they're made out of bronze, so it must have hurt like hell. But, you know, the problem is that you get these fixed ideas, like you do often in the West, like, there's only 120,000 kilograms of gold above ground, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, they haven't done an inventory of the Fed in this century, and they haven't done an inventory of Fort
Fort Knox.
Knox.
Some claim it's even missing, right? It's just gone. They don't have it anymore.
Well, they either don't have it or they have a hell of a lot more than they want to admit to.
Mm-hmm.
My supposition is that all this gold, let's just concentrate on the gold that was recovered after World War II from the Third Reich, and also the Japanese gold that's been recovered.
Is that, sorry, but is that like one unit, or were this still in different parts of the world at the time?
Different parts of the world at the time. I mean, the American military was huge in Europe during the war. It was very small in the Far East. They had General Stilwell and a couple of military units with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he had very, very few Americans. They had to make it seem that he was more powerful and more effective than he was. Well, actually, he did defeat the Japanese finally in Burma and did things like that. So no question he was a hell of a good general. But let's just consider how much gold they found in Europe when they collected it all. Well, they found in the salt mines near Salzburg in Austria great quantities of gold that had been, you know, recast by the Deutsche Bank. I can't remember the German name for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in Asia, they recovered much, much more than that. I would say that all in all, in Asia, they recovered somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 trillion in gold. Now, that's just me talking to you. You know, if I were being grilled before the Supreme Court, I'd have to admit I'm not sure. I don't have any idea, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The amount of gold that I see coming out through my sources, and I know a hell of a lot of people that are scooping up gold in the Philippines and bringing it out, particularly the Japanese.
From the ocean, correct?
Well, some of it comes from the ocean, but the great majority of it is taken out of caves and hiding places in the mountains that have mm-hmm. been built. You know, they've excavated tennis court size places where they built the whole thing up with rebars and concrete, and then they filled it with gold ingots, you know, different size ingots, either biscuit bars or big 75 kilo bars, which take two guys to carry. And they have brought out so much of this stuff already. They've had ships carrying it around all over the world, putting it in different banks, hiding it in different holes. Well, Marcos was giving an awful lot of it to the United States in return for gold bearer certificates. So the whole idea was that the U.S. wanted some gold. And Marcos had lots of gold. And so they would, in a sense, borrow this from him and promise him a certain percentage interest rate and give him a gold bearer certificate. Well, after a while, Marcos discovered that these gold bearer certificates were counterfeit, and that, in fact, they were counterfeit by the Bureau of Engraving and Printing in Washington. And They're counterfeited in the way of misspelled words, flaws in dates, signatures that are not quite right, and stuff like that, stuff that you'd never know. And then there's another form of counterfeiting they use, in which they make it a little bit more conspicuous, and they say the reason that that's in there is because that will help us to know that this is a legitimate document you've got here. Because you're here while we're putting that in. You know it's there. We know it's there. And when we see that you have that same flaw in your document, it'll prove that it's valid. Well, that's rubbish. And so in the end, if you take a 75 kilo gold bar and you take the ingot around to your favorite, most highly respected bank, and you give it to them for safekeeping, which is a very bad idea, give you a gold bearer certificate, and you can bet your life it's got so many fleas in it that you won't realize what you're holding in your hand until you walk around the block. And that's all I'm asking you to do. Walk around the block and go back into the same bank and ask them if they've ever seen you before. And they'll tell you they don't know who you are. They don't recognize you. They didn't see you today. They didn't see you yesterday. And this document you got in your hand is a counterfeit printed in Hong Kong. That's happened to so many people. I mean, people that I've checked out and I've trusted as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've heard the stories about those who discovered tungsten in their gold bars as well.
Well, tungsten's almost as valuable as platinum, okay? Mm-hmm. Because they use it to put on the tips of rockets and bullets and cannon shells and so forth, because it's one of the hardest elements there is. And it helps penetrate the armor plate on the tank. So one of the few places on Earth where you can get tungsten in any quantity is in China. So the things that they're smuggling out of China, if they can, are opium, heroin, especially Chinese white, and tungsten, gold, and silver, and platinum. So, you know, the amazing thing is that this bank you walked into, say you went into Citibank, gave them this document, gave them this gold, and they gave you the document, you walk around the block, go back in there, and they won't know who you are.
Because they want to take the gold from you, and they never want to give you back the real thing, correct?
That's correct. They don't want you to ever see that gold again. And here's a true story. Okay, the guy who tortured General Yamashita's driver, or is said to have tortured him, he may have bribed him instead, into admitting that he knew where 12 different vaults were in northern Luzon. And he could indeed take them to each of these places, which he'd taken the general to, so that he could sign off on each vault. And, you know, just as a courtesy to the emperor, go back and say, I signed off on each of these personally. What happened is that the giving of these fake notes to people in exchange for gold got to be so commonplace that now people are scared to go looking for gold in the Philippines anymore. This was a guy who could take you around, take you to the vault, show you how to get into the vault, and once you were inside, you found you were in a tennis court-sized place that was just 2 meters deep in 75 ingot, kilo gold ingots.
Mm-hmm.
Then this stuff is taken out. It's put in ships, usually, because it's so heavy, rather than aircraft. You can only carry several bars on an aircraft. But they would take this out of Subic Bay and bring it either back to the United States, or they'd take it down to Australia, where they would convert gold. Gold can't be put on the gold market unless it's got a proper paper trail. And you've got to know where the gold came from, who mined it, because where it came from will determine exactly what minerals are included in the gold. So to be, before anybody will believe that you're dealing in honest gold, let's call it, they have to be able to look at the paper trail, and they have to be able to run it through mineral tests so that they can find out if it has the right minerals to prove that it was taken out of the ground in Java or in Sumatra or in Burma or in Thailand or wherever.
Okay.
It's got a fingerprint in the mineral content. And all of this stuff has got to be done before you can put it on the London gold market. So you have to be pretty careful or you're going to end up with 13 years in prison, you know, because you walk in and you've got documents that turn out to be counterfeit. And you've got, say, you know, cookie-sized bars or cracker-sized bars of gold. And they have the wrong kind of fingerprint to go with the paperwork, and you'll end up in prison.
Even if you bought it in good faith?
It doesn't matter. There's no way you can prove good faith.
The thing is, you have governments who are interested in repapering gold and in sponsoring the re-smelting.
Yeah, that's basically it. You have governments that want your gold, whether it's your gold or not your gold, or whether it's stolen or whatever it is. What they want is they want to get the gold from you, and then they want to make it disappear. Ah, I remembered what I was in the process of telling you before. The guy who allegedly tortured Yamashita's driver ended up with a single account at Citibank in New York with $50 million in gold. Now, we checked this out by going and looking at his financial documents that were registered at the state government in Albany. And we found the documents. We found he did indeed have the those accounts with those numbers on them at Citibank. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So then the attorneys that were acting for our associates got a hold of the CEO of Citibank and a room full of attorneys and representing him. And they tried to persuade him that he had to give this $50 million in gold back to the widow. And he wouldn't do it. He said, we don't have any accounts. This guy, Santa Romana, doesn't have an account in our bank. And so forth and so on. So he threw them out. His attorneys told them to leave. They left. And a short while later, the $50 million in gold was moved from Citibank, New York, to City Trust in Nassau in the Bahamas. The reason for that is to get it offshore so nobody can run a trace on it, because there are all these other countries that will be happy to have that gold on their soil. And if they don't have to prove anything, if they don't have to chase any paper, and it's all off the books.
Don't forget to mention all these documents
along
the CDs.
Yeah, when we finished writing Gold Warriors, we realized that a lot of people were not going to believe it. They're just going to say, this is absurd. How can you have that much gold in on this planet? Well, we decided to produce a bunch of CDs that would have digital copies of as many of our documents as we could pack onto them. So we ended up producing three CDs, and essentially you can see on these documents photographs of the people involved. You can see photographs of the letters that convey this information. All the people that were smuggling with Marcos, they've all signed off on these things. Marcos's signature, of course, is there. the Citibank records are there,
mm-hmm.
all of this stuff. And it actually got affirmed for us in an amazing way. There is an attorney in Los Angeles who was approached by a guy named Roger Roxas, who was just for his fun of it, he went looking for gold. And he happened to find a tunnel that went underneath the hospital in Baguio, the resort city in up in the mountains north of Manila.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was getting all his buddies to help him clear the tunnel out, you know, open up the mouth and then let it air out for several weeks to get rid of the toxic smell. They went in and they're exploring this tunnel when they discover that they're on a slab of concrete that's 2 meters wide by 2 meters wide. It's almost 1 meter thick in its top piece. So they shattered this thing. They knew something had to be hidden down there. And to cut a long story short, they found a solid gold Buddha from Burma that was sitting down there, weighing 1 ton, exactly 1 ton. So they got the hoisting gear that you usually use with an A-frame. And they hauled this thing out. Took them days to get it out of the pit. And then days to drag it into this truck. Took it back to his house. They took it with all everybody he had, hauled it back and tucked it beside the bed in the bedroom, between the bed and the wall. That night, Marcos's uncle and General Vare, the chief torturer from Malacañang Palace, who's, you know, his signature is pulling your eyeballs out. They showed up with a gang of guys, and they stole the Buddha from Roger Roxas. So Roger then got the daylights beaten out of him and, you know, was tortured. He was put in prison for a while. But when he finally got out, friends of his in the United States got this California attorney to take on his case pro bono. And what he did was he took our book, The Marcos Dynasty, and he had detectives track down all of our sources that we listed at the back of the book. And he took depositions, video depositions and mic definitions from all of them. And he presented this as a large part of his evidence to a U.S. court in Honolulu. And he won the case.
Well,
and he won the largest civil award ever given by a U.S. court to that date. So, you know, that made us feel pretty comfortable because that meant, well, court judges the books straight, you know, we're not.
The entire court suit is on the
CDs. Oh, yeah, the entire court suit is on the CDs.
That's right. I want to give you opportunity, Sterling, to mention that as well as we kind of begin to round things up here for the first hour. We're kind of deep into it right now. But before we go there, I want to, you know, mention your website and stuff like that as well. But we might have jumped the gun, so to speak, on a few of the topics. So why don't we, in the last few minutes here of the first hour, just give us an overview. Let's go just zoom out a little bit and go back. And let's just talk a little bit more about some of the main people involved. I know this is a huge topic and we're going to carry on in the whole next hour to talk about this, but just a brief overview in a way to kind of summarize it for a little bit for some people who are not aware of this. Where the gold came from, basically how the Japanese got their hands on this. Was this during many years or did all of this happen during World War II? And maybe you can just break down, you know, who Yamashita was as well for us.
Well, we always think in terms of World War I and World War II, but the Japanese-Chinese War actually started before that in 1895. And at that point, what happened was Japan invaded Korea and seized the country and turned it into a colony, looted it from one end to the other. And this is an ancient, ancient culture, what is now both North and South Korea. As soon as they'd finished doing that, they turned around and they invaded Manchuria, which doesn't have much in the way of gold and other things like that, but has wonderful natural resources. So they were able to turn it into the biggest opium production center in East Asia while they were occupying it. By this point, it was in the early 1920s, and I'm correct, 1930s, and they decided it was time to move down into China. They had originally thought of invading Siberia, pardon me, but they decided on heading south instead, since the Russians were a lot tougher than they were. They headed south, they got down to the Great Wall, and they were just on the outskirts of Peking. When we get around to the late 1930s, and in 1937, this is when the looting really began, because the Japanese army came down into China, down nearly as far as the Yangtze River, which is in the middle, and was just looting everything and shipping it all back through Manchuria and Korea, and then across the strait into Japan. This is how the whole thing began, and it got the emperor nervous because he was concerned that his troops, his officers, were going to lighten the load on its way back, that they were going to help themselves to as much of their treasure that they were stealing as they would like. And so he called in his eldest brother and asked him to please take charge of a new agency they were starting, which was going to be called Golden Lily. Golden Lily being, in Japanese, the name of one of his haiku poems. This was carried out. They started an enormous enterprise, another CIA. But this was charged with taking possession of all the imperial, what they call the imperial treasure, that could be stolen from these places they were conquering, not just ordinary treasure. This would be everything, including fabulous scrolls, you know, stuff that if you auctioned it off in New York or London, you know, you'd get 30, 40 million for it. And this stuff was all sent back by train through Korea and then by ship over to Japan. And it was tucked away in various places that were controlled by the emperor, including the basements at the Imperial Palace and a huge cavern up near where they had the Olympics in Japan a couple of years ago. They moved then in 1937 down and seized Shanghai completely and looted it totally from end to end. Then they moved over to Nanjing, and they had what was since called the Rape of Nanjing, where Chiang Kai-shek politely took his army out of the city before the Japanese arrived and left the civilians all there to get murdered. And almost all of them were murdered. There were a bunch of Europeans who were there, missionaries, diplomats. In fact, there was even a Nazi ambassador who was there, who was a very nice guy, and he was defending these poor people who were getting their heads lopped off. There was gang rape going on in every street. There were groups of people having, groups of Japanese officers having competitions to see who could decapitate the most Chinese in the course of one day. So it was at this point that things really got serious, because things were really getting nasty, okay? It was turning into a really nasty war. And the Chinese army wasn't anywhere around to defend anybody, so everybody just got looted. All the collections, all the beautiful collections in Nanjing, which was at one time the capital of China, all these things were looted. All the libraries were looted. And in the course of all of this, the princes helped themselves. There were at least 8 or 10 princes who were in Nanjing at that time. They all confessed later on to having horrific nightmares of the atrocities that they observed, which was pretty persuasive. And this is when the thing then spread to be something covering all of East Asia, because the next stop on the Japanese agenda was what we now call North Vietnam. They took over Hanoi thanks to the French saying, we'd rather you didn't destroy it, just you can have it. And at that point, they jumped off from there to Thailand, which also gave in without a struggle. And then they came across into Burma, where I was at the time, although I was just a kid. I have very, very vivid memories of the Japanese invasion, of getting strafed and bombed. And then they proceeded down the Malay Peninsula, taking Singapore, and then taking all of Indonesia. Now, everywhere they went, you need to know that they not only stole the gold and the diamonds, and whenever they found somebody with jewelry of any kind, they took the stones out of the jewelry, put the jewelry in one oil drum and put the stones in another oil drum, so that they had the stuff ready to go by ship back to Japan. And one of the things that naturally galled me is that my father had a hospital on the border of China, and the Flying Tigers had an airbase across the valley on the other side of the river, on the China side. And the Japanese were flying up from Hanoi and bombing and strafing the Flying Tiger base. And every time they did that, they would then save some bombs and, you know, some belts of ammunition and come over and bomb and strafe our hospital. Well, we managed to get out of the place about 3 days before the Japanese army arrived. But we couldn't take our dogs with us. We had 2 Irish terriers. And so we left them with some people we trusted dearly, who were going to pretend they were their dogs. When the Japanese got there, they tracked them down, took the dogs, took everybody in the village, gathered them around a big banyan tree in front of the hospital, roped the dogs up by their hind legs in the tree and hacked them apart with their sabers, and said, this is what's going to happen to you if you do anything we don't like. And this is what's going to happen to the Seagraves if they should show up. It galled me a bit. And I think I like the Japanese essentially in a how shall I say, in a cultural way. I like them very much. I like their music. I like, you know, their art, their gardens, and everything else. But boy, can they be vicious. Their army was just farm boys being run around by a bunch of princes and a bunch of essentially gangsters. So, you know, Yakuza.
Right.
The worst of the bad.
Now, Sterling, let's get into this in more detail here as we continue our discussion in the next hour. This, it's a big story. There's many different components to it. We're trying to summarize a lot of history here as well. And we want to give a plug out, obviously, for the website here as well, bowstring.net, just one word, bowstring.net. And primarily the book we've been talking about here, well, they're all related. They're all about the Far East. But Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. You can find many more books on the website, bowstring.net. And also I want to mention the CDs as well, again, that you mentioned. If people go to the website and simply click on the Buy Now button, that's how you find the CDs, because they're not listed down below. So if you want to find out more about this, that's where you should go and read more about that, because that's all the references. That's the reference source for a lot of the stuff that you talk about in the book, correct? Is there? Does that mean that there's no references in the books specifically?
Oh, no, the books are packed with references, but we thought people might like to see all the photographs. We have photographs of the Japanese recovering the gold from a ship that had been disguised as a hospital ship. And then when Hirohito surrendered, they sank the ship out in the harbor. And then they came back only about 20 years ago, and they recovered it, and they took color photographs of the whole thing. So we put all the color photographs on the CDs too. You've even got Shinto priests, you know, doing all the nice things to bless the gold as it's coming up out of the water, what have you.
All right, really good. This is very interesting. We're going to talk more about this then, so stay with us, Sterling. We'll be right back after this short break.
What is water do? What is in your man to war? What is water do? In your man to war? What is water do? What is in your man to war? I'm all drank muddy water, gold teeth in a harbor low. Ain't got nobody. I'm all here by myself, but nobody, all here by myself. But nobody, all here by myself. Well, the women don't care, but the men don't need me. Well, I'm going to the river. Well, walk it up and down, going to the river, walk it up and down. Going to the river, walk it up and down. Well, I don't find Faustina, gonna jump overboard and drown. Now, about to shine my light, like a headlight on some train, about to shine. Like a headlight on the train. By the time, like a headlight on the train, I would shine my light and follow the train. Well, it tell me that southbound train out of Red Lake, not Lord, that southbound train out of Red Lake, not Lord, that southbound train had a regular sign. Give it a section for my name, Senor Rio Grande. Well, the girl I love, and the one I pray to see, woman I love, when I play the scene. Woman I love and the one I pray to see. Was she living in Memphis and the fool all right to me? Outstanding woman, what have I said and done here? Mama, what I said and done. Hey, mama, what have I said and done? Treat me like my trouble has just begun.
Stay tuned to Red Ice Radio for more coming up with Sterling Seagrave in the second hour. We'll talk more about his book Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. We'll look closer at how Japan systematically looted Asia and what happened to the plundered treasure after 1945, when it was secretly recovered by Washington, D.C. and used as a global slush fund. On the new website, redicemembers.com, you have our full archives going back to 2006, with radio, TV episodes, webcasts, films, videos, and commentary. Sign up for a membership and get access and comment on the program, as well as subscribe to our RSS feeds. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Barbara Oakley on pathological altruism. Then Paul Hellier, Douglas Dietrich, Katie Diolos, Mark Gaffney, and Rick Simpson, to name a few, will be with us. Tune in whenever you have the time, stream or download commercial-free radio on demand. And we're going to carry on right now with Sterling Seagrave for more on Gold Warriors and Yamashita's Gold.